I next met with Dr. Anne LaCase from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, who participated in our symposium at the ONS Congress on the Management of Lymphomas and Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia. To begin, Dr. LaCase discussed how she evaluates a patient with newly diagnosed CLL.
The first thing with CLL is to think about whether the patient needs treatment. And a lot of the patients we initially meet do not need treatment, regardless of having oftentimes quite an elevated white blood cell count. So what we really focus on is the bone marrow able to make the other cells that are necessary, including red blood cells and platelets? Does the patient have large lymph nodes or an enlarged spleen that are causing symptoms? Does the patient have any other symptoms that are related to the underlying disease, which are usually fairly uncommon on initial presentation with CLL in this, unless someone has a really late pickup of their disease? So I think a lot goes into the education of the patient about what the disease is and what our long-term goals are, because we know that if we treat someone right away with CLL versus treating them when they have an indication for treatment, it doesn't change the overall survival. And our goal is to really support patients through what we hope to be many years of illness and treat when we need to and support them in other ways by looking out for risk of infection and making sure that they are properly vaccinated and get age-appropriate screening and all those other sorts of things.
Could you backtrack a little bit and talk about how you explain sort of what chronic lymphocytic leukemia is to a patient and, you know, sort of how to understand what to expect in the future?
So what I typically say to patients is chronic lymphocytic leukemia is a disease of the B lymphocyte, which is one of the immune cells that helps your body fight particular types of infections. And what happens, as with any cancer, is you have a single cell that essentially gets a mistake in the machinery of the cell and starts to copy itself. And you get a collection of cells that are all related to each other, growing sort of out of control, and that would be considered a malignancy. In terms of selection of therapy, we really make a big distinction between not only does the patient have a 17p deletion and look at that mutational status, but how old is the patient and do they have any comorbidities? So with older patients, we tend to use more gentle therapies like antibodies. Obinutuzumab and chlorambucil is a very good regimen for elderly patients. And when I mean elderly, you know, 75 to 80, there are certainly some 70-year-olds who are in pretty good shape. So we really try to look at the whole picture and not just the number of the age. And we know that that is an extremely tolerable combination and has better progression-free survival than using rituximab plus chlorambucil. In the younger patient who is mutated and does not have a 17p, this is the group where we still use chemoimmunotherapy, the fludarabine, cytoxan, and rituximab, because we know that those patients may have very prolonged remissions. And in fact, there may even be a subset of those patients who go on to be disease-free long-term. I think you have to follow people for many, many years and decades to know whether they are truly, quote, cured from the FCR. But we do push that because of that long-term data out of MD Anderson and other places. For younger patients who have 17p deletions, we go directly to novel agents, usually ibrutinib.
Let's track back through a bunch of the things that you talked about, because there's just been so many new things in CLL. But the first thing you mentioned was that particularly in older patients, you think about chlorambucil and obinutuzumab. Could you talk a little bit about what obinutuzumab is, how it compares to rituximab, and why we're using this rather than rituximab, at least in this combination?
So obinutuzumab is the first type 2 CD20-directed antibody, and it's engineered to bind more tightly to CD20 and enhances cell killing by other immune cells. So we know that in comparison to rituximab, it works better in CLL. In particular, CLL doesn't have as high response rates to rituximab as a single agent as other subtypes of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, probably because of the density of CD20 on the surface, and it's usually dim. So we have made the move to using obinutuzumab in older patients, and it is associated with infusion reactions like rituximab. And those infusion reactions happen on the first time you give the drug, so you have to watch people pretty carefully. Once they get through that, it tends to be very well tolerated.
Can you talk a little bit more about the infusion reaction with obinutuzumab qualitatively? Is this pretty much the same thing as rituximab? How often is it such a problem that, you know, you have to maybe think about stopping the therapy, and any other toxicities that have been seen with this drug?
So I think the infusion reactions with obinutuzumab, there are more hypotension and sort of as a consequence of the infusion compared to rituximab. Rituximab, we usually see hives and itchy skin and that sort of thing, but with obinutuzumab, it can be a little bit more dramatic, and you really need to watch particularly older patients very carefully. I think if you pre-medicate patients who have difficulty with that initial infusion with steroids for several days, you know, relatively high-dose steroids, you can really mitigate that infusion reaction, and most patients can then go on to receive the drug. But I think you need to educate the patient and work very closely with the infusion nurses in terms of what to expect, because it is a little bit different than the reactions we see with rituximab.
So you also talked about FCR, fludarabine, cyclophosphamide, rituximab, particularly in younger patients where, as you said, trying to launch a patient into a remission that won't require any treatment. Can you talk a little bit about the kinds of toxicities you see with FCR and why it is that it's really not given in older patients?
So the major toxicity we worry about with FCR is the myelosuppression. And even in our younger patients in their 50s, oftentimes they become quite cytopenic by the end of 6 cycles, and they can have pancytopenia. They can have delayed recovery of those counts. So that's something in a patient who's older, who may have some underlying trouble with their stem cells, it can be quite profound. The other issue with FCR, with a fludarabine-containing regimen, it affects T cells significantly, so you need to prophylax patients for zoster and for pneumocystis. And I think, in general, patients with CLL have a very high risk of developing zoster, so I'm always sort of looking for a reason to put them on indefinite antivirals.
So, of course, the other major option in upfront therapy is the novel agent ibrutinib. Can you talk a little bit about what ibrutinib is, how it works, how well it works against the cancer, and what kinds of tolerability issues there are with it?
So ibrutinib is a BTK inhibitor, so it is part of the B-cell receptor signaling cascade. So when B-cells are activated through this mechanism going down through the B-cell receptor, and BTK is one of the proteins in that cascade. So if you block that protein with this oral drug ibrutinib, you can turn off the growth and division of these cells. So it is, in general, a relatively well-tolerated drug in terms of, you know, it's rare to see nausea. Sometimes you can see some diarrhea, but it's really quite well-tolerated from that perspective. The two things that we look for carefully in patients who are on ibrutinib include atrial fibrillation, which seems to be a risk of about 7%, and it happens in patients who have underlying cardiac risk factors and in older patients, and then the risk of bleeding. It has an antiplatelet effect, so you need to hold the drug if patients are going to have any sort of invasive procedures, and if patients have traumatic injuries, if they fall and hit their head, then you really need to look carefully for subdurals and other, you know, bleeding complications. I think if you educate the patients carefully and they know what to look for, it is a very otherwise well-tolerated drug, and it is very effective, has very high response rates, and we see patients on this drug for years. Resistance can emerge, but at least in my experience, it's been fairly rare that we have seen ibrutinib resistance.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about, you were kind of talking about this idea of the upfront therapy of the typical patient, but what about those with 17p? How do you approach first-line treatment and then second-line treatment for them?
So typically for first-line, we would use ibrutinib. If you have a patient who cannot get ibrutinib because of a contraindication, you know, AFib or bleeding or for whatever reason, or in the second-line, if someone progresses on ibrutinib, we would go to venetoclax, the BCL-2 inhibitor, which is another extremely active drug. Very well tolerated with the exception of the risk of tumor lysis. So this is the drug where you need to be extremely cautious in initiating therapy with venetoclax. Fortunately, the guidelines are very clearly written in terms of how to initiate the drug and step up the dose and what monitoring you need to do for tumor lysis.
Could you talk a little bit about actually what happens with tumor lysis syndrome and how it's prevented and managed?
patients are risk stratified according to the burden of their disease, looking at white blood cell count higher than 25,000 and the size of nodes. Are they under 5? Are they over 10? And you get a low, medium, and high risk patient. For the high risk patients, they come in the hospital and you pre-medicate them with allopurinol and you start them on lots of fluids and you assess for their tumor burden. If they have a high uric acid or a very high LDH, those patients may get preemptive raspirocase. And then once the drug is given, it's very frequent laboratory monitoring every few hours to make sure that the patient is not becoming hyperkalemic, because it can happen extremely rapidly. I've never seen anything quite like it, to see a drug work so quickly. So fortunately, you know, I think being in a high volume center, our nurses have a lot of expertise in treating patients with venetoclax, but it can be a little bit scary to see how quickly the disease can kind of melt away.
Can you talk a little bit more about some of the supportive measures that are undertaken and why they're undertaken? Maybe a little bit more about sort of what uric acid is, why it goes up, and what the different ways are that you can manage it.
So uric acid is released when tumor cells are killed. And when uric acid accumulates in the blood, it can deposit into the kidneys and cause kidney failure. And that can happen very rapidly. And in addition, when these cells start to kind of fall apart, they release cellular contents, including potassium and phosphate, and you can get hyperkalemia in the setting of renal. You know, if your kidneys aren't working well, you can't excrete that potassium, and patients can have fatal arrhythmias if the potassium gets too high. So we watch the potassium, we watch the phosphate and the calcium and the uric acid. So allopurinol brings down uric acid and is a medication that we use very commonly and start people on before they start treatment, so that you can get the uric acid lowered before you even start to kill off the tumor cells. Raspirocase is a more direct way of getting rid of uric acid, and it's an IV infusion. It is a very expensive drug, and it can cause methemoglobinemia and hemolysis, so it's something that you don't want to use repeatedly because the risk of that can go up if you're using it more often than once. So we really try to risk assess the patient and use raspirocase when we need it, but to rely also on giving IV fluids, and diuresis protects the kidneys. This is the one situation where you give a lot of fluids and then take off a lot of fluids with the Lasix to keep the uric acid solubilized and prevent it from depositing in the kidneys.
It reminds me of all the discussions we have of potential autoimmune toxicities of checkpoint inhibitors. And at the end we go, yeah, but probably none of this is going to happen and the patient will be totally fine. Is that kind of what happens with venetoclax?
For the most part, yes. Yeah, I think we've learned a lot over time about how to manage these patients, and it generally goes very well.
And I guess the other thing is, I think that we've learned about it is because it's so effective, to kind of ramp the dose up, not start. You know, it's kind of this whole process. Can you talk about that?
Right. When the clinical trials were initially being done and patients were starting at a higher dose, there was a lot of tumor lysis and there were a couple of patient deaths from tumor lysis. So that led the company to step back with all the investigators and lots of experts and reassess how to give it safely. So it started at 20 milligrams with a ramp up to 50, 100, 200, and then 400 in a weekly fashion. So it's very controlled and it's very well documented in the package insert, which is nice. You know, we all refer back to that when we admit patients. I like to look at it again just to make absolutely certain that everybody's on the same page.
Let's move on and talk about follicular lymphoma, particularly upfront treatment and some of the things that are going on there. Again, maybe you can sort of just take a step back and provide a broad overview of the disease. And again, what the typical issues are that you're thinking about when you see a newly diagnosed patient.
So follicular lymphoma, similar to CLL, is an indolent B-cell lymphoma that is often picked up incidentally when patients have imaging for another reason or present to primary care physicians and have a careful exam and the lymphadenopathy is felt on exam. And many of these patients, when they are first diagnosed, do not need therapy, and we spend a lot of time sort of discussing why. And again, therapy for advanced stage follicular lymphoma is not curative. We can eradicate a lot of the disease, but it comes back over time. The one exception to that is when patients present with stage 1 disease, which is, you know, maybe 15% of the time we will use radiation and a subset of those patients may be cured. But for the rest of them, which is the vast majority, we treat if patients have bulky or symptomatic disease, if they have low blood counts from marrow involvement, or have steady progression. And I think the art to treating follicular lymphoma is to try to treat people before they become symptomatic, sort of at that critical tipping point. So we do a lot to sort of educate patients as to why we are not treating them right away. And that's often a long conversation. And in terms of initial strategies, there's really two schools of thought. One is to use single agent CD20 antibodies like rituximab as a single agent, and the other is to combine rituximab or a CD20 antibody like obinutuzumab with a chemo drug. And the chemo drug we use most commonly now is bendamustine because it in general has a favorable toxicity profile. So for patients who have lower volume disease, sometimes we'll use rituximab as a single agent, emphasizing that the overall and complete response rates are lower than with bendamustine plus rituximab, but you may be able to avoid chemotherapy. So, you know, it really depends on the patient, how much disease they have, what their performance status is, any comorbidities in terms of trying to figure out, do you start with single agent rituximab, and then if they don't have a complete remission, then come in and add the bendamustine, or do you start right up front with the two drug combination? And I think in our younger patients who have a fair high burden of disease, we know that rituximab may not be as good if patients have bulky lymphadenopathy. So in those patients, we would usually use bendamustine plus rituximab. And on average, people stay in remission 6-7 years with BR. So, and now there's this emerging data looking at obinutuzumab as opposed to rituximab showing a benefit in progression-free survival. So that is another option.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about really comparing obinutuzumab to rituximab with chemotherapy. And when I first heard about these other anti-CD20 antibodies, I think a lot of people were thinking, oh, there's no way they're going to be better than rituximab. And as you mentioned, with CLL, at least in that one trial, it seemed for sure like it was better. And I don't know, this trial, you look at it, I mean, I don't know if it was enough to get people to change their practice, but it sort of did seem like it had better efficacy in FL.
Yeah, it did show better progression-free survival. I think some of us are using it. It probably will depend on institutions and what institutions decide to do. I think the other thing that's coming along that is really very interesting is this sub-Q rituximab. It's kind of exciting. I mean, it sort of emerged all of a sudden. I mean, those studies have been, the Sabrina study had been going on for a while. And I think many of us were not really aware of that until we saw the preliminary data.
Absolutely. That was the next thing on my list that I was going to ask you about, which was because we were talking about that. And I think it's just really fascinating. Can you go a little bit more into, first of all, how sub-Q rituximab is given and what we know in terms of, you know, how it compares to IV rituximab, not just about efficacy, but also infusion reactions?
So I've not used it yet, but from what I know, it looks like the efficacy is identical to using IV rituximab. And from what I've read, it sounds as though you need to give one dose of rituximab IV first, and then you can give the subcutaneous infusion over 5 to 7 minutes. It's given with a hyaluronidase to, I guess, promote its absorption. And reportedly, there are no infusion reactions if you give it sub-Q.
And how long does it take? The patient still comes in, though?
We haven't implemented this yet. I suspect we're going to be talking about it soon. You know, I think if patients are coming in for chemotherapy, you know, if they're going to get an infusion of bendamustine, they'll be coming in anyway. I think, yeah, the bigger question is for people who are getting weekly rituximab as a single agent, would we have patients administer it at home? And I think in patients who are otherwise well, you're not worried about tumor lysis or anything else, we could certainly think about having it given at home.
Well, I guess that also leads into the other thing I was going to ask you about FL, and I should ask you about CLL too, which is this issue of so-called maintenance treatment.
Right.
So in FL, the strategy's been out there of giving, in some situations, as you mentioned, chemotherapy, say bendamustine with an anti-CD20 antibody, but then after the chemo stopped, to continue the anti-CD20 antibody, for example, for a couple of years. How do you decide whether or not to do that? And again, what are some of the issues in keeping somebody on one of these agents for a couple of years? And it seems like sub-Q rituximab might fit in well there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest issue we run into when we give patients maintenance rituximab, particularly the 2 years, when I give rituximab as a single agent, I use the European, the Swiss SAC regimen where you give sort of extended induction. So they get 4 additional doses every 2 months and then you're done. So it's 8 total doses. When you give a dose every 2 to 3 months, we do see delayed neutropenia associated with rituximab. We also see hypogammaglobulinemia. You can see repeated infections. So in our practice, I think most people after bendamustine do not necessarily give maintenance rituximab. I think if you look at the gallium study with the obinutuzumab, that was done with maintenance. So you sort of want to follow the study that demonstrated the benefit. So I think I would, in a patient getting obinutuzumab, at least present strongly that option. If I'm giving R-CHOP for follicular lymphoma, say you have a grade 3A or you have someone who has a high proliferation index. So sometimes we see these follicular lymphoma where more cells are dividing than you would expect. We get a little bit nervous about that. Nobody really knows what to do. Sometimes we treat those patients with R-CHOP. When I use R-CHOP or if you use RCVP in an older patient you don't want to give an anthracycline to, then I often do give maintenance rituximab based on the PRIMA data, which showed a significant prolongation in progression-free survival. In CLL, we haven't really been doing as much maintenance. There's data for lenalidomide and there's some data for anti-CD20 antibodies, but have tended not to do that because the toxicity may be more important in that patient population than in follicular, in patients who often have underlying hypogammaglobulinemia from their disease. And after treatment, many of these patients have very low IgG levels.
Getting back to follicular lymphoma, the issue of a non-chemotherapy approach, in particular, one regimen we've heard a lot about is the so-called R-squared regimen, lenalidomide and rituximab. Can you talk about what the thinking is with this combination and what we know about it, particularly in FL?
So we know in the upfront and the relapse setting that it is a very active combination. There have been phase 2 data from MD Anderson showing very high overall response rates. And it generally is quite a well-tolerated drug. And there's a randomized study comparing it to upfront chemotherapy that we're looking forward to seeing some results from. I would think that would be out relatively soon. I think the one issue with lenalidomide that I worry about a little bit is what is its impact on bone marrow stem cells and the risk of secondary malignancies. Most of that data has been presented in multiple myeloma. But if you have a very young patient and you're trying to avoid chemotherapy, I worry a little bit about lenalidomide. I may be in the minority there, but I want to see a little bit more long-term data and some randomized studies before I think I'm going to start using that as an initial upfront regimen, because I think you have good options with rituximab alone and chemoimmunotherapy. But I don't know, maybe in the next couple of years, once we see that data, we'll start to shift towards that as an initial strategy.
Well, you would think, particularly in the older patient, that might be, you know, where maybe you don't want to give chemotherapy.
Right.
What about the tolerability issues when you add lenalidomide in there?
Lenalidomide tends to be relatively well tolerated. It can cause cytopenias. Patients can get muscle cramps. The one thing I've had a little bit of trouble with is diarrhea. I've had a couple patients who had really profound diarrhea on lenalidomide. You need to worry about risk of thrombosis, so we put people on a full aspirin. But in general, you know, it's on for 21 out of 28 days, and people tend to tolerate it really very well.
So let's go on and talk a little bit about mantle cell lymphoma. And again, can you sort of provide a little bit of a capsule about how you visualize the disease and, again, what you think about when you see a patient who's newly diagnosed?
So mantle cell lymphoma sort of falls right between indolent and aggressive lymphoma, and it sort of has some of the characteristics of both and not the favorable characteristics. So unlike diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and aggressive lymphomas, it is not curable with combination chemotherapy. And unlike follicular lymphoma, the duration of remissions tend to be, and the overall survival is much shorter, you know, on the order of 7 to 8 years, as opposed to probably now 20 years median survival with follicular lymphoma. It tends to present in older men. It can involve the GI tract and lots of extranodal sites. And it is quite a variable disease in terms of its clinical behavior. There are some patients who present like CLL patients with splenomegaly and circulating disease in the blood without significant lymphadenopathy. Those patients often have a very indolent course, and we don't treat those patients just like we wouldn't a follicular lymphoma patient. there are some patients who are kind of in the middle where the proliferation index is between 10 and 30%. And they have, you know, if they have low volume disease, sometimes we will observe those patients as well, as there's data from Cornell to suggest there isn't a survival disadvantage to that approach. But for the majority of patients who have mantle cell lymphoma, they have a fair burden of disease and we treat them when we first meet them. There is a group that has very aggressive disease, the blastoid variant in particular, and also the pleomorphic variant. These often have very high proliferation signatures with 60, 70% of the cells dividing, and we know that disease is much more aggressive. So in terms of initial treatment strategies, similar to CLL and the indolent lymphomas, we often look at the age of the patient. For our younger patients, we tend to give them initial chemotherapy using, in our practice, we use a combination of bendamustine plus rituximab, which is a very active regimen in mantle cell lymphoma. And then we typically incorporate some cytarabine because that drug also appears to be very important based on randomized data from Europe. So we use that combination and then take patients to an upfront autologous stem cell transplant because the longest remissions we see in our younger patients are in patients who've had stem cell transplants on the order of 5 to 7 years of remission. This dates back to the early 2000s when there was a randomized study comparing interferon to transplant back before patients were routinely getting rituximab, and there was a benefit to transplant versus interferon, which we obviously don't use anymore. But that has remained a standard treatment for younger patients, and by younger, 70 to 75, if those patients who are 75 are in good shape, we would consider doing a transplant. It's pretty controversial because in the era of rituximab, we don't have a randomized trial comparing rituximab maintenance versus stem cell transplant. So that study is going to be done and is just opening in the U.S. where patients who have a complete response molecularly with no minimal residual disease after initial therapy will be randomized to maintenance rituximab versus auto transplant plus maintenance rituximab, because we know that after transplant, if you give rituximab for 3 years, it's associated with an overall survival benefit. So I think we all sort of look forward to the results of that study to know, do we still need to really hit this disease with a hammer and use our most aggressive chemotherapy regimens? For older patients, you know, we typically will use bendamustine plus rituximab. It's really very well tolerated. There's also data using the combination you just mentioned, rituximab plus lenalidomide, which came out of Cornell. And that also seems to be a tolerable and very active regimen.
Can you talk a little bit about the involvement of the GI tract that's seen with mantle cell lymphoma? Because it seems kind of unusual.
It is unusual. And every year we have several patients whose initial presentation is having been found to have polyps on a screening colonoscopy, and it often can blanket the entire GI, you know, the large bowel. And it can also involve anywhere from the oral cavity all the way down. And patients can have bleeding. Often they're not symptomatic necessarily from GI tract involvement, but it is very common, tonsils, base of tongue, all the way down. So it's a very interesting disease. The vast majority of patients have stage 4 disease when they present. Most will have bone marrow involvement as well.
Could you talk a little bit also about the management of recurrent mantle cell lymphoma after this first upfront treatment that you talked about? Right now, we have 3 agents approved, ibrutinib, lenalidomide, and bortezomib, and another, venetoclax, that we talked about before that there seems to be a lot of activity in. What do we know about these 4 agents in mantle cell and kind of how are they sequenced?
So we know that bortezomib has a response rate of about 30% in relapsed and refractory mantle cell lymphoma. And I think given its toxicity profile, it's associated with painful peripheral neuropathy. Some of these patients will have had prior vincristine. It causes a lot of just sort of fatigue. I think in mantle cell, it's not terribly well tolerated. So I think that has become a less commonly used drug. Lenalidomide has an activity of 30 to 50%, so a little bit better. It is well tolerated, so that is something that we will often go to, though really our first line relapse drug is ibrutinib because it has the highest response rate at over, you know, in the vicinity of 70%, and again is well tolerated in the majority of patients, again with the caveats of looking for bleeding or atrial fibrillation. It can also be if a patient has had a long remission, you can combine it with rituximab. And it is really very effective. I have some patients who've been on it for several years without evidence of progression. when patients then progress, I think, you know, you could go to lenalidomide, but I think given the data emerging with venetoclax having similar response rate to ibrutinib and being a very well-tolerated drug, we try to get that drug approved for our patients and do the ramp up. They tend to have lower burden disease and a lower risk of tumor lysis because most of the patients don't have a huge circulating component of disease, but I think you do have to watch those patients carefully. And we've been successful in obtaining the drug based on the level of evidence that is out there from the initial studies.
Let's talk a little bit about Hodgkin lymphoma, and maybe we can emphasize more the uncommon scenario or less common scenario of the patient who has relapse disease. But if you could, again, just provide a broad overall perspective on Hodgkin lymphoma, but specifically the issue of the patient who has disease relapse. We know that a lot of these patients will be cured with chemotherapy. Maybe you can talk about how often you see relapse disease and sort of how you think it through.
So Hodgkin lymphoma has been one of the great success stories in oncology, and it's really a great disease to treat because the vast majority of people do well. The majority of patients are young, though there is a second peak in the mid-50s. Patients typically present with contiguous lymphadenopathy, most commonly in the neck and chest, and can be associated with B symptoms. The other two, occasionally you'll see intense pruritus without a rash. These patients kind of bounced around and seen a lot of providers before someone does a careful exam and finds the lymphadenopathy. Sometimes they can have pain in the lymph nodes where the disease is found after drinking alcohol. So those are two uncommon but very interesting symptoms that people sometimes present with. The majority of patients present with stage 1 and 2 disease, and those patients do extremely well with ABVD-based chemotherapy. I think in the U.S., we use almost exclusively ABVD, though there is very good, very high-quality data from the Germans using a more intensive regimen, escalated Biocop, particularly in patients with higher risk, bulky stage 2 or stage 3 or 4. That regimen is associated with infertility and risk of stem cell damage. More people go into remission, but the overall survival is no different. So we really don't use that, and we use, I think, for the most part, ABVD. In people with stage 3 and 4 disease, which is less common, about 75% of patients will be cured with ABVD. So overall, you know, we at a referral center see a fair bit of relapse disease, though this is, again, the minority of patients who present with Hodgkin's. And our current algorithms now are to use second-line chemotherapy, and if a patient achieves a complete remission, to go to autologous stem cell transplant with high-dose chemotherapy and stem cell rescue. And the majority of the patients do well with that. In terms of what is the best second-line regimen, this is a matter of debate because we do have novel agents that have been approved in this disease, including brentuximab vedotin, which is the antibody-drug conjugate to CD30, and checkpoint inhibitors. The complete remission rate with brentuximab is about 30%, and when you want to get a patient to a stem cell transplant, you really, the data suggests that having a complete remission going into transplant is a very strong predictor of long-term disease-free survival. So we tend to use combination regimens. We've done a study. There's a study with brentuximab plus bendamustine. That is a very active regimen, is one option, or ICE chemotherapy or other standard salvage. Couple cycles, patient in remission, go to auto transplant. For those patients who have localized disease or have disease after salvage that's in a radiation field, we do at that point then typically incorporate radiation if a patient hasn't already had radiation, or we'll do it after transplant if they're in complete remission. For those patients who do not have radiatable disease or have a poor response to salvage, that's where we'll start using drugs like brentuximab or checkpoint inhibitors, both of which have very good activity. Brentuximab is used as maintenance for a year in patients who have undergone autologous transplant and high-risk features, including extranodal sites or early recurrence. So that's something that we offer patients. And then the checkpoint inhibitors are very active. Though it's interesting, patients don't typically have complete remissions, but they have shrinkage and then stability of disease over long periods of time. And now the question is, how are we going to move these very active drugs up front so that few of our patients relapse? And soon the Echelon study will be presented comparing ABVD versus brentuximab plus AVD in stage 3 and 4 disease.
So you mentioned these two novel, I mean, Hodgkin lymphoma is really a classic disease for chemotherapy, one of the first, maybe the first disease actually cured with chemotherapy. But you mentioned these two other alternatives are really interesting. Of course, we've heard a lot about checkpoint inhibitors all over oncology. Brentuximab vedotin, as you mentioned, is an antibody drug conjugate. The other one that we hear a lot about is T-DM1 and HER2-positive breast cancer. Can you explain what an antibody drug conjugate is and exactly what B-vedotin is, how it works, and what kind of toxicity issues you see?
Absolutely. So CD30 is a protein that sits on the Reed-Sternberg cell, which is the malignant cell in Hodgkin's and is the minority of cells. When you do a biopsy in Hodgkin's, you see a small number, 1% or less of cells, and these are surrounded by lots of other cells. So using the success of rituximab in B-cell lymphomas and targeting non-Hodgkin lymphoma and targeting CD20, an antibody was devised to CD30, and it had really no activity. And fortunately, after that experience, the companies didn't give up on that as a target and actually combined this antibody to CD30 with a chemotherapy drug called MMAE, which is a microtubule inhibitor and prevents cells from being able to divide. And this has been a very successful drug. It binds to the surface of the Reed-Sternberg cell and is taken into the cell, and then the chemotherapy drug is released and it kills the cell. So the type of toxicity that we see with this drug is predominantly peripheral neuropathy, which can be quite significant, particularly if patients have had prior vinblastine. It can also cause drops in blood counts, and there are a number of rare side effects like pancreatitis or liver dysfunction, though in general, it is well tolerated. You just have to watch people for the peripheral neuropathy, which can be motor neuropathy, whereas with vinblastine and vincristine, that typically tends to be sensory neuropathy. Sometimes you see motor with brentuximab vedotin.
You were mentioning that in the higher risk patients who've had transplant, B-vedotin is often used as a consolidation or maintenance for a year. What typically happens in the year in terms of neuropathy? Are most of the patients able to get through a year of this without neuropathy? And what do they first complain about in your clinical experience?
So I think most patients don't get through the whole year because the majority of them have had prior vinblastine, and the two together seem to be higher risk for developing peripheral neuropathy. And people tend to complain of similar issues in terms of numbness and tingling in the fingers and toes that gets progressively worse over time. And then I've had some patients develop some foot drop or frank weakness from continued treatment. So we try to, particularly because it's given as maintenance and we don't have measurable disease, I think we're quick to drop the drug when we see that you're about, we don't want patients to develop motor neuropathy, so we try to drop it quickly when we see trouble.
You were mentioning that in the relapse setting, or maybe I don't know if that's true in general, you see a 30% complete response rate with brentuximab. What do you see in those people who have complete responses? Again, the relapse, not the pre-transplant setting, in terms of how long these complete responses last.
Some of them can be quite durable, and there's been a couple of publications that have shown of the patients who have complete remissions, there are a subset of patients who can go on to have continued complete remissions and may even be cured by brentuximab. So the overall response rate is 75%. So it is a very active drug, and I think once we start using it up front, we'll have to see how things shake out in terms of the maintenance and down the line use, but it can be a very effective drug.
And you also mentioned checkpoint inhibitors, and I guess it's pembrolizumab and nivolumab that are approved, I think both of them in Hodgkin lymphoma.
That's right.
So, in what situations do you use these agents, and how do you choose between the two?
So we use them in patients who have recurred after autologous stem cell transplant, usually who have also had prior brentuximab vedotin. We also will use it in patients who have relapsed disease where we cannot achieve a complete remission to get a patient to autologous transplant. We use checkpoint inhibitors. And, the biology is really fascinating in that the Reed-Sternberg cell has extra copies of chromosome 9p that encodes for the two proteins, PD-L1 and PD-L2, that are the targets of this drug. So it really is the poster child for checkpoint inhibitors. And, honestly, I usually pick pembrolizumab just because of the schedule. It's once every 3 weeks as opposed to once every 2 weeks with nivolumab.
So what do you see in terms of efficacy when you do use this therapy?
It is quite effective. 65 to 70% of patients will have remissions that are, you know, by the definitions of shrinkage, though a lot of the patients will not have complete disappearance of their disease. Usually we're following these patients by PET scan. And it's hard to know what is inflammatory and what is really true disease. And, you know, I think we often sit tight in these patients as long as they're not progressing and try to ride it out and see how long we can. I have patients who've been on these drugs for more than 3 years without any evidence of progression.
So a couple of more final questions or issues. We were talking about brentuximab vedotin and Hodgkin lymphoma. What about B vedotin in other lymphomas, T cell lymphomas, and other B cell lymphomas?
So it's indicated in anaplastic large cell lymphoma, where it is a very active drug. And you can see I've seen some remarkably rapid responses to the drug. It has even higher response rate than in Hodgkin's at like 85%. Those are fairly rare patients, but it is very active. It can be active in angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma, which is sometimes CD30 positive. In the other T-cell lymphomas, it's a little bit less predictable.